Welcome to the Assembly of Silence Radio Hour. This audio program has been carefully packed to the legal limit with a weekly allowance of non-governmentally approved deep thoughts per square minute of podcast. And now, here are your hosts, Judah and Noah.
Here we are.
Part two of
the previous one. We're
going
to continue to discuss
nourishing
the soul of a child.
Yes.
And so soul is one of the concepts here that we need to kind of zero in on. And there's one thing that you said that I thought was really wonderful and helpful that has to do with the relation of the thinking, feeling, the heart, mind, soul part in relation to what is called the etheric.
Right.
And so how our health can be largely determined by the thought feelings that we have about the phenomena we're undergoing. And I think the example you use has to do with attitude towards food, that one person would have this association with food that's just inherently nourishing, that they're just their experiences with it have been positive, and so they're looking forward to the meal, and their digestive juices are ready to go, and the whole thing is just happiness, you know? And in the other case, you may have people who've had, in a variety of ways, negative experiences with food, and so when there's a meal coming up, there may be worry, there may be various forms of anxiety, so that will really impact the degree to which that food can be nourishing.
Right. That's going to put them in a stress situation, a stress response, and that's going to diminish gastric secretions, digestive juices. It's going to slow gut motility. So it puts one in a sympathetic nervous system state, which is not conducive to digestion.
And so in a way, what we're seeing there is the cyclical imprint of the patterns experience, kind of the mirroring that occurs, and then the imaginative structures that occur around those taking on a kind of solid form within the soul body and impacting the relationship with experience happening from thence on.
Right. So to understand the soul body and the etheric, I guess what I should lay out is that I speak of a fourfold human being. And the first fold or the first sheath would be the physical body, which is made of the earth. It's mineralic. It's you know, from dust we came, from dust to dust we'll go, right? So the physical body in and of itself is of the physical realm, and its trajectory is death and decay. So it requires an enlivening force. And that enlivening force is the life body, which we've done. That was our second topic for this show, was the life force, right? The life body. And that in the human organism can be found in the glandular secretions. They are what bring life into the body. Or they're the secretions that when we have thoughts, when we have digestion happening, it's glandular secretions. It's secretions that provide the life forces that are, you know, so when we eat, we stimulate secretions which bring us life force, right? And when we think, if we can control our thinking and feeling life, meaning that we don't swing, you know, highs and lows and extremes, but the more calm and balanced and centered and equal we become in our emotional life or in our thought life, then that's easier on our secretions. Our glands don't have to work so hard putting secretions out, right? So then there is the life of the soul, and the soul is our thoughts, our feelings, and our will impulses, our drives, desires, passions, our instincts, right? And so the way you can look at this is that the soul wears the body like a jacket so that it has access to the external world through our sense perceptive organs, our eyes, our ears, our nose, our mouth, the skin, which is fully innervated. So the soul puts the physical body on like a jacket so that it can take in the external world through sense stimuli. And that as sense stimuli streams in, it engages the nervous system and it goes to the brain for processing. But there's this critical point with taking in that information is our perception of that information. Mm-hmm. And the way we perceive that information that's coming to us via our nervous system, that's going to determine the glandular secretions that happen afterwards.
To some extent.
To some extent, exactly. So the glandular.
We have kind of an autonomic process that's somewhat independent of that, you know,
yeah.
there's basic like patterns underlying the biology that will be influenced to a large extent by how the soul body interprets.
And this is the point of where I was going with digestion there is that, you know, when you take that stimuli in of meal and the perception is joy, then the glandular secretions are adequate
right.
for digestion.
Right.
If the perception is fear, then the glandular secretions associated with fear are inadequate
right.
for digestion, right?
I can attest to that is absolutely 100% true.
So that's the life of the soul that I'm talking about. So when we're talking about nourishing the soul of the child, we're talking about how to nourish the thoughts, the feelings, the will impulses of the child.
Yeah, but in some okay, so you know I have some problems with this model. Right?
Yeah, I do.
But
yeah.
That's not to say that I don't think there's a lot of value in it and that there aren't profound things that come from it. And so I think that this is one really helpful way of looking at things. But I also feel like there's a fundamental problem with the model. Mm. And I'd like to get to that. But when you're talking about soul here, in some respects you're talking about like ego. Right?
No. Well, okay, I mean, I guess in some
it
respects,
depends
yeah,
on
the
how
little
you,
ego. Little
yeah, the little ego.
Ego. The little
so now
ego,
we have
yes.
to get into a whole bunch of word definition
yeah,
shit, which
yeah.
drives me nuts. But okay, here we go, right?
Yes.
So when most people talk about ego, for instance,
right.
they're talking about the individual ego. They're talking about technically, I think Freud thought of the ego as a mediator between the id and the superego. So it's basically like this individual structure that's trying to navigate the tension between its internal drives and the demands placed upon it by the external environment. Mm. Something along those lines. Mm-hmm. So it's a very like it's very much about self-preservation.
Right.
It's wrapped up in the thoughts and the feelings.
Right. In identity. It's wrapped up in
identity. And identity.
In identity.
Exactly.
Right.
So all of that is one package.
Yeah.
But if
it thinks it's this body.
Right. Exactly. Yep. Or the variety of other identifiers
yeah,
that
it
might apply
it's
to
the
itself.
Thoughts, right?
Yeah.
It thinks it's the thoughts. It thinks it's the feelings. It thinks it's
a group identity, perhaps.
Right, right. When that's actually not what it is at when that's not what we are at all.
Right. right? But then that question of what we are, right, is something that gets beyond
right.
this soul thing
well,
and moves more towards the I.
The I, exactly. Or we could say capital E. Ego.
I know. That's what I hate. So
I don't like that one. I like the I. I like the I because all of us, only I can say I, right? So it's the universal I.
Yes.
So there's only
one
I.
I think that's beautiful. And it's, of course, the seeing I.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So I think that's a beautiful way of delineating the difference between the spiritual being and the kind of individual consciousness.
Right. And so that I that we're speaking to in this particular tradition, in the Steinerian tradition, in the Western esoteric tradition, you know, everything physical is a carrier of something spiritual. So the physical body contains the soul and the spirit in it, and to some degree, right? Because it's not the spirit can't be separate from the body. It has to be anchored in the physical body because that's how that's the experience it's having right now.
Well, this gets to the key of the. You have something else you need
to
say?
Yeah, I just want to, because let me just tie this knot. And that is that in this path, the eye's home in the body is in the blood. And so if we look, when we eat, and we break the food down into its individual nutrients, those nutrients go into the blood to be delivered to all the cells and tissues of the body, but it's also going into the blood to give the eye a taste of what its experience is in the physical realm. Just as with breath, streams right into the lungs, straight into the blood, and provides the eye that experience as well.
To me, that makes almost no sense whatsoever.
Oh, my God.
because the eye is a spiritual, is like the spiritual center. It's the spiritual center.
But it's having a physical experience.
Are you sure?
It's in a body having a physical experience.
Well, but I mean, the spiritual traditions say that it is unconcerned with the happenings in the material realm.
But it's
that's
anchored,
basically the lesson right. that Arjuna is given, right? That's what Krishna tells Arjuna and says, don't worry about the fate of other beings, right?
Because they all return to him.
Because it's an imperishable, I'm going to say yes. I, but of course the word translated usually is soul, which confuses everything. But it's the imperishable unity of being. Yep. Right? And from that point of view, it has no attachment to any particular body.
It doesn't have an attachment to it, meaning that it's
we don't freaking know. Like whether it wants to experience it or not, right?
Right.
We could say that, it's a root of being and its isness has no particular qualities that we can necessarily discern, but by relinquishing our sense of ego individuality, we can subsume ourselves into it, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't think we have any sense of what it wants, and whether or not it's interested in the experience happening in our body. Maybe.
Right.
But I don't know. The whole idea that like in the blood and all that kind of stuff, it's like, there's some interesting poetic resonances in that, right? Like I think of the wine and the wafer, being passed.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that it's a corpus, right? So, you have the body of the church, right? Mm-hmm. And, of course, the body itself being the movement of the blood and feet. But what's really going on there is that the cells are being fed.
Yes.
So the idea that the body consists of mineral, which is generally considered to be inert, right? Mm-hmm. Unconscious being. I can't buy that. To me, it's all what you said. It's repeating self-organizing systems with emphasis on self, right? So it's basically nothing but consciousness, right? And the body is basically a collection of consciousness that's being managed by, so there's many layers of these networks of consciousness. Yes. That's how I see the whole freaking arrangement.
My favorite way to describe all of this is there's one creator, creation, teacher within.
One creator, creation, teacher within.
Right? So that,
okay.
That one thing, that one creator created all of creation and is instilled into the very core of our being. It's the teacher within, right? And thy will be done, right? On earth as it is in heaven. Steiner has one where he says, may we perform your will as it's laid down in our innermost being.
Right.
And so it's all of this that we're talking about is built into the essence of who we are.
But of course, the innermost being is the I.
Is the I.
Not the ego.
Or the self, which is in the heart.
Okay, wait. So what does self mean in this case?
I would say the I. I would say it's like the I. The self is the I.
Okay. The innermost being. Yeah, I guess that fits with the Vedic way of looking at it,
exactly,
right?
Exactly.
So which the innermost being is this spiritual unity, in essence, right? Mm-hmm. So when Steiner says, thy will be done, right, in the innermost.
Yeah, may we perform your will as it's laid down in our innermost being.
Yes, so the question is, what are we considering to be our innermost being? Mm-hmm. If you're placing it in the soul, where it has to do with your own intention.
Right?
That's tricky. And I think that Steiner, in some respects, because he made so many claims, there's a fair amount of soul activity in his work.
Yes, there is. But I would say that the self is not in the soul because the soul is bound to the senses.
I agree.
Right? So we have to withdraw the senses.
Yes.
We withdraw from the senses and we go inward. And therein we find the self.
Right. But therein we also find the relinquishing of our sense of what should happen.
Right.
Right.
And that's a tricky word, should, right?
Yes.
What should happen, air quotes,
right.
Should.
Should is an artifact of the soul.
Yeah.
Right? It's our thinking feeling that makes us want particular outcomes.
Yes. And it's so expectation.
Right. And so the I would be something that is accepting and not trying to force
exactly
things to go its way.
The I is what is.
That's why the Buddhists say isness.
Isness.
I don't know how they actually say it because they didn't speak English, but that's how they translate it.
That's like their definition, their term, their translation. It translates into isness.
So yeah, so then we need to talk about the etheric aspect of it, because that's kind of like your interface between soul and
physical body.
Physical,
yeah,
right,
exactly,
and. I have trouble with that as well, because it's not an integrated way of looking at all phenomena. It's like, oh, there's this stuff that's inert, that's just mineral, that like tends towards death and decay. It's like, well, on a certain level, not so much as the other parts, because the physical mineral, right, is a molecule or atom, and it's going to continue to be that even when the body is disenlivened.
Yes. But what we can do is but if you look at this, so let's look at a rock or a stone, right? So it doesn't have a growth force to it, right? It doesn't
well,
have...
Well, some people would say that's not true, right? It depends on... I know that like over geological time, geologists will speak about rock formations as if they were sort of growing things.
They don't reproduce. There's not reproduction.
Some rock is formed by dying beings. Mm, mm. And so you could say that really,
That's not an inner force, an inner driving force of it. Meaning that like if you leap from rock world, the mineralic world, into the plant world, where you see actual growth forces. You see forces that bring something sprouting to life and growing, and also dying and decaying at the same
hair?
Time.
So is hair growing?
Mm.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, supposedly, once it's out here, it's quote, dead,
yes.
Right? But the forces that cause it to continue to be generated are coming out.
Are life forces.
Right.
Yes.
It's similar to rock in that sense, right?
No, because in a rock, you don't see growth and flourishing and withering decay in simultaneity.
Oh, well, you do. Because
no, you don't.
Yes, you do. There's erosion. I mean, if you see
erosion
rock...
Erosion is different than death and decay, though. I think maybe perhaps there's the confusion. Death and decay is the loss of a life force, whereas erosion is just the dissolution of
well, you could say that
it's
that
physical structure.
That anything that's exposed to a hostile environment. So like oxygen is an oxidizer, and it causes, there to be a chemical reaction that tends to rob electrons, and so then you get like a surface that gets marred by it,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of the process that causes skin to slough off and that sort of thing, right? So, part of the process of decay is the environment that it's under stress from, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you could think of the Earth in general as being a gigantic organism that has, rocks moving and forming and churning in the same way that we have fingernails, they're coming out and little bits get chipped off here and there because you're doing stuff, and there are other things that might come along and clip them a little more neatly, and that's kind of what human beings are doing with the rocks, and then it's being regenerated from a variety of other living parts, right, that go into the rock formation. And that's a lot what's happening with rock. A lot of rock were from the mineral deposits of sea organisms, shells and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Gets all ground up and eventually...
Limestone,
exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and who's to say whether, previous yugas provide the raw material for many of the other rock formations too.
Right.
So I think it's an analogous type of process. And from my point of view, there's a neater way of structuring it where there's a uniformity at all levels of scale, where you're basically talking about network relations of conscious entities. Degrees of freedom are kind of what really is being talked about when you're talking about life, right? So you can say that there's consciousness existing throughout, but there are conscious beings that are really locked into very particular operations, like atoms and molecules and particles even more so, right? But then when you get to like a cell, it has a little bit of freedom, but not a heck of a lot. You know, one cell—
It has a duty.
It has a duty. It has a range of operations that it's going to, you know, perform more or less well.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. To the best of its ability.
To the best of its ability, given its environment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and its environment is the organ it's in, or the membrane or whatever it is. And then the environment of that is the totality of the body.
Which is determined.
Which is essentially enervated with the soul consciousness.
Right, which is determined by our thoughts, our feelings, and what we put in our mouth. And
thoughts, feelings, and decisions, because what we put in our mouth is an action.
Exactly.
In essence, right?
Exactly, yeah.
So I like that model. I can work with that. I mean, the differentiation between the I and the soul is beautiful, right? And I like that terminology too, because the soul feels like one, limited, like the soul survivor, right?
Right.
Whereas the I, even though it denotes one, it's denoting a unity one.
Yes.
You know? Right. So there's some great, beautiful, that there's where your poetic truth comes in, right?
You have to listen to the talk, really, to hear the—
Which talk?
The one we're talking about.
Oh, the talk we're talking about? I did listen to it. That's where I'm talking about.
No, I know.
It.
I'm telling all the—
Oh, you're telling the audience
I'm
to
telling
listen
the
to
listeners.
It.
You
well,
have to go listen.
Hopefully they did, because hopefully this is— I mean, our devoted listeners are sequentially moving in a in an orderly fashion through—
Hopefully.
Because we have this whole thing planned out. Everything is going to be like sequentially revealed as we go through, right?
Right.
Didn't we have that meeting when we started?
I think
to
we
figure
did.
Out exactly what we were going to do all the way along the way and plan it out so that everything was like a gigantic epic poem.
So one of the things, so coming around to that, one of the things I like to say about the I is that the more individualized we come, meaning the more we strip away anything that could potentially be a block between connecting to another individual, like anything I have an identity in, my religion, my race, my color, my affiliations, anything I say, I am this and I am that and I am this and I am that. Any of those, as we start to strip those away and we get more and more to the core of our onion, you know, we start peeling the layers away and we get to the core of who we are as a true individual, the more universal we actually become. Hmm. So the more individualized we become in the I, the more universal we become.
Yeah, I remember you saying that in the talk, the talk that we're talking about. I think that it's an interesting thing. There's some truth to that, but there's also a way in which individuality causes disruptions to the cyclical rhythms. Because, you know, now ideally, when we tune into that deepest I, we subsume the soul and move with the Tao.
Right.
So that we're basically part of the overall pattern of life.
When we tune into the I, we withdraw from the senses.
Yes. And so then the question, now getting back to that, so then why would the I want to experience the senses and the blood? You know, if what we're really doing is honoring God, which is, you know, that the unified consciousness, and what we're doing by doing that is relieving ourselves of the torment of our senses, right? And the appreciation is shown through the experience had in so doing, right?
Strangely enough, it's through the senses that we get there too, right?
That's right. We use the senses to disable the senses, just like we use the mind to disable the mind.
Exactly.
You know, because they are essentially the same thing. You said something else here that's all great. All senses are the source of food, right?
Yeah.
But you also said that touch is the archetype of the senses.
Yeah.
You know, which is a really, really interesting phrase.
Yeah, the touch is the archetype of all the senses because everything touches in, right? So when you're looking at something, it's light waves that touch in on rods and cones, right? And
well, now, if we're going to be technical about that.
So, well, hold on. Hold on there, Mr. Analytical. But aromatic molecules touch in on...
Can't argue with that one.
Right? Tastes touch in on taste buds, right?
Uh-huh.
So sound pressure waves touch in on hair filaments in the ears. And the tympanic membrane, right?
Mm-hmm.
So touch is the archetype of all the senses. Everything touches in,
right,
to stimulate.
So the thing that's really interesting to contemplate is that if you're going to retreat from the senses in appreciation of the eye,
mm-hmm,
then in essence what you're doing is you're – what's the right word? I want to use the right word here, damn it.
Allow it to come.
You're relinquishing the touch.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
So the discipline of it is that whatever it is that I'm going to experience, it is not going to touch me in relation to the eye.
To disturb my connection to the eye.
Right.
Yeah.
And so even like the difficulty, of course, is in the various perturbations that come in, the things which distract us.
Mm-hmm.
But even if we're still thinking about it, we're not quite there.
Right. Right. The goal is imperturbability.
Forget. Yeah. To right. forget that you exist in a body.
Right.
In essence.
Yeah. And to realize that this is not you.
Right. And that gets back to, you know, Arjuna's discussion with Krishna.
Yeah.
Right.
Where Krishna says, they're all you. They're all me. They all of, you know, they will, when you kill your cousins, they will come back to me. They
right.
will,
right.
because they came forth from me, they will return to me.
Right.
You're right. So there is no death. There is no birth.
Now, it's of course, all, you know, some people will say, and I just have to mention this because I'm the guy who's constantly turning over the apple cart here. So some people will say, well, that's just a mechanism of military training. It's like an entrainment kind of hypnosis
mm-hmm.
that's being transmitted through these ancient stories as a way of kind of tempering the soldier for the kinds of horrible deeds they're going to have to do,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can certainly make that case. I think that that's not an unreasonable way of looking at it. But like most things, I certainly don't think that that's the whole story.
Well, there's
go ahead.
There's a moment where Krishna reveals his cosmic form to Arjuna.
Yes, yes.
Right? And it's you know,
beyond, too much.
Beyond anything anyone could ever possibly, you know.
A confusion of mouths and of eyes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Just like...
All the universes within him, like unending galaxies within him. It's just, you got to read it. It's the most beautiful description of anything I've ever read.
Oh, the whole Bhagavad Gita is incredible.
Yeah. You know, if you don't want to read it, you can go on YouTube and just type in Bhagavad Gita. And there is like a 2.5 hour reading of it.
Yeah. Well,
and it's really well, the guy reads it really well. Some of the music gets too loud at some points, but.
Bhagavad Gita as it is?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a really good reading too.
Yeah, and so you know you can listen to it, and it's really great to listen to because
it is.
It's,
I mean, that's the only way I can do long form stuff. Like, is anyone reading the Mahabharata?
Well, the first volume of the translation I'm reading is 820 pages, and the second one is 650 pages, and this the only fully translated version was done in the late 1800s.
Wow!
And it's thousands of pages.
Maybe I'll read it when I'm dead.
You'll be absorbed into it. You won't have to worry about it.
Good. At least I'll have read it eventually.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's phenomenal. Yeah. So read the Bhagavad Gita, or at least listen to it and listen to when Krishna reveals his cosmic form to Arjuna. And it's.
And Arjuna's like, enough. put yourself back together for me. You know, please return to your regular form. I can't bear this.
I can't handle it. I can't handle it. Yeah. It's phenomenal. I mean, Krishna, and I'm enamored with the being of Krishna from reading the Mahabharata. And I look forward to reading the Bhagata Parva, I think is what it is, Bhagata Parva. But it's the whole story of Krishna's life.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Interesting. So is that the third of the great epics?
That's the third of the great epics, yeah.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. So you have the war in the middle.
Yeah.
And the first
and the third one is kind of like a reflection. They go back and they talk about the life of Krishna before the Mahabharata.
Huh.
Yeah, so you get to hear about his childhood and so on and so forth. So it kind of brings you up to speed.
Huh.
Yeah. And I mean, the Mahabharata was quote, written, I mean, it was an oral tradition before it was ever written down by Vyasa, who is, or Vyas. It's interesting. There's A's at the end of a lot of letters, and they're silent, or a lot of words, and they're silent, huh. But I don't know which. But, so it might be Vyas is his name. It's spelled Vyasa.
Huh.
And so he is actually a character throughout the entire Mahabharata. He's the grandfather. He's one of the grandfathers, I believe, of the Pandavas.
Huh.
And he's a sage. Huh. And so he goes and eventually writes the Mahabharata.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he lives through the whole... this whole period.
Yes.
And it's interesting that you have this oral tradition that eventually becomes written. It seems like that, you have to wonder what happens in a civilization where at some point they decide, we got to write this down. You know, after having probably a pretty long history of oral tradition.
Yes.
And yet at some point there is a need to place things in writing.
And even, yeah,
the written word is just so different from the spoken word,
right?
And there's an interesting book called "The Alphabet Versus the Goddess," that's written by I think he was a surgeon, and his name is Leonard Schlein. The basic premise is that the formation of written language coincided with the transition from matriarchally structured or civilizations to patriarchal, and that. It really was kind of more warfare-oriented societies that started writing shit down.
Because you start losing the mental capacity for memorization.
But it also may just be simply the process of, as human populations got larger and larger and came into increased and protracted conflict with each other, there was more disturbance and therefore more difficulty in having time to memorize and maintain tradition.
Yeah.
So you'd need to have the shit written down just because it was chaotic and you never knew when your people were going to come in and try and cut your head off.
Right. And then you lose the tradition.
And you lose the tradition.
Right.
And there are many stories of civilizations where, they're trying to preserve their traditions under attack. So the sacred texts and the sacred objects get collected and ferreted away somewhere, or sometimes they're stolen and then the culture goes into crisis.
You know,
there's that part of the Bible where they're talking about the kings of Babylon having taken the objects of the Hebrew temple, right, and using them to drink out of and basically committing disrespectful acts.
Yes.
And thereby incurring the wrath of God. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is this one of those moments or is it just a musical interlude?
I think it's a moment.
It's a moment.
It's a moment.
Sure, if we covered it all yet, but that was
Despite everything we're saying here, you really should just listen to it because.
Well, if you didn't listen to it,
none of this would make sense.
Why would you be listening to this?
This is true.
Go back and listen to it. We should have said this from the beginning.
That's true.
If you made it through these two episodes, and then got to the end of it and realized you didn't listen to the thing we were talking about, go check it out.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Either that or you're a really dedicated fan. That I seriously doubt.
Well, there's definitely some dedicated fans out there. Okay.
All right.
Always a pleasure.
Always.
I'll catch you next time.
Thank you, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, throw us a bone by subscribing to this channel, visiting our social media pages, and hitting the various like, love, and clap buttons. We welcome all comments, criticisms, and random thoughts. Our email is silentassembly@protonmail.com. And if you want to be an angel, we have a Patreon page at patreon.com/silentassembly. We look forward to serving you again soon. In the meantime, remember, turn that thing over a few times before you pick it up and take it home.